KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining us today on the show. I should mention up front that we are recording on July 5th, 2012. I am very excited to have on two people who are experts in the world of vidding, which we're going to be talking about this hour. Professors Francesca Coppa of Muhlenberg College, as well as Tisha Turk of the University of Minnesota at Morris. Vidding is a phrase that many of you may not be familiar with, but many of you may also know exactly what it is when we define it in a nutshell, and we are going to be refining this definition and fine-graining over the course of the hour. Vids are those fan remixes of works of art, of movies, of literature, and so forth that we find on the internet, often by YouTube, but often other places, that transform a particular piece of art into something perhaps different. And oftentimes we will see these kinds of transformations occur in humorous videos, in videos that make us laugh, but also in very serious ways that cause us to, or at least based upon the artist's goal, reflect upon, laugh at, or change our perspective of a given piece of work. And this community of vidding is one that has gained prominence, at least in my opinion, since the dawn of YouTube, but has been around for much longer than that in other formats. And in our conversation today with Tisha and Francesca, we're going to dig deep into these communities. Tisha and Francesca are part of an organization called the Organization for Transformative Works, and we're going to be talking about that organization and what it does and what transformative works are. Because when we think about vidding, for those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, and particularly the lawyers out there, you're immediately thinking copyright. You're thinking taking someone else's work of authorship and changing it in ways that perhaps that author would not want that work to be changed, or at a minimum would want to be asked for permission to make that change, which raises the issue of fair use, the classic defense to copyright infringement that says that there are certain uses of works of copyright, of works of authorship, art, again, literature, movies, and so forth, for which the author has no right to offer permission. In other words, the new author, the person creating the work, can use that work of authorship, not worry about copyright, at least from a legal perspective, and go ahead and do their work. From a practical perspective, copyright law, as we know, is much more complicated than that, and oftentimes there are assertions of rights that may or may not have merit, but that may, by virtue of asserting the right, prevent this new author from actually doing work. The classic cease and desist letter, the letter sent out by a copyright owner saying, you are using my work in a way that is illegal, that violates copyright law, and you must stop. And sometimes those letters have merit, but other times they don't. The question for the recipient of the letter is whether they are going to fight that assertion, or whether they're just going to say, this is too much of a hassle, too much of a problem, will cost too much, I don't know what I'm doing, I don't have access to a lawyer, and so forth, and buckle. And when you have authors that buckle in the face of a claim which lacks merit, we should be concerned. We should be concerned because, in fact, we will not have the creation of new works of authorship, of new art, of new film, and so forth, that would allow our society to advance. In our discussion today with Francesca Coppa and Tisha Turk, we are going to be digging into these issues. But importantly, we're going to be digging into these issues from the perspective of two professors who are not lawyers, who are in fact, the humanities, and in the case of Tisha, who is actually a vidder as well. And both Tisha and Francesca have been involved in several legal issues involving questions of what the law should look like, including, and we're going to talk about it a bit, some proposals in front of the Copyright Office to think more carefully about what the law around vidding should look like. So I'm very excited to have on these two experts in the field, who are recommended, by the way, by a former guest on Hearsay Culture, Rebecca Tushnet from Georgetown. And I'm excited to have them on, both of them joining us us via Skype. And I should mention again, before we get started, a bit more about their background. Francesca Coppa is a professor of English and director of film studies at Muhlenberg College in Allentown and is joining us via Skype from her home in Manhattan. And Professor Tisha Turk is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota at Morris and is joining us from her home in Minnesota, also via Skype. Tisha and Francesca, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Let me start off, Francesca, I guess, with my standard background question, and Tisha, you can pick it up as well. So my question usually when we start off is your background a bit more and how you became interested in fan videos.
Right. Well, I mean, in some ways, the video part came later. The fan part came first. And, I've been sort of part of the media fandom community since I was about 11 years old. I was the Star Wars generation of media fans who came in at sort of, 1981, 1982, which was a great time to be a science fiction fan. You had, Empire Strikes Back, and you had Blade Runner in theaters, and you had, The Wrath of Khan coming out in 1982, and I can wax very happily about that. But anyway, I've been in a sort of media fandom community before I was a professor. And as somebody who was part of the community of media fans, vidding is one of the art forms that the media fan community really developed in the mid-70s. And so I came to see them and appreciate them and was later in my career in a position to write about them and defend them.
And Tisha?
I came to fandom much, much later than Francesca did. I actually spent the 80s and 90s reading a lot of science fiction, but not watching TV because I was the sort of pretentious teenager who thought that TV was bad. Then I discovered X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the late 90s, and the rest was sort of history. I first discovered vids. Vids are actually what pulled me into media fandom in a major way. I had been sort of lurking in fandom, and then I discovered vids, and I thought, well, this stuff is great. This is amazing. And I was in the middle of my dissertation at the time and desperately looking for ways to procrastinate on it, and vidding turned into a really wonderful way to do that. But it wasn't until several years later that I started writing about it. I mean, my specialization was in post-colonial literature and narrative theory and a bunch of other stuff. And I had sort of run that into the ground, and Francesca had started doing work on vids, and she had a really amazing article that came out in 2008 that I had read and thought was wonderful. And I had been seeing other people, mostly media scholars, writing about vids, and I felt they didn't get it. I mean, even people who were sympathetic and people who were sort of well-intentioned, I just felt that they weren't sort of understanding the art form like someone who had been doing it for a while would. And I thought, well, there aren't a lot of us who have a foot in both of those worlds and who are positioned to do both. So I guess that's going to be me. So I started writing about it, very much with Cheska's support, actually.
And that gets me, before we get into some of the details here, to a broad question. I mean, both of you are, again, as I mentioned in the introduction, not lawyers, and yet law is interfering, as perhaps one way to view it, but there are other ways to view it, with what you do. And it gets us to perhaps the unfortunate reality of having to define a few terms. So before I even ask you about the Organization for Transformative Works, with whom both of you are affiliated, what is a vid and what is a transformative work? And perhaps, Tisha, since you were speaking, I'll ask you that question about vids before turning to the broader question of a transformative work.
Well, vids are there are a couple of different ways of thinking about vids. If you see one, what you're seeing is a music video, right? It may, on the surface, look like an MTV music video in that it's a song, usually a pop song, although not always, with clips from a TV show or a movie, and the little people move to the music. It's very different, and this is something that Francesca has written about. It's very different from an MTV music video in some significant ways. So, Francesca, let me toss that one to you.
Yeah, I mean, so a vid is a fan-made music video. As Tisha said, it may look to the uninitiated spectator like a commercial music video. But while a commercial music video is usually provides visuals to illustrate music, a vidder uses a song to tell a new story about or criticize or comment on the visual source material. So a vidder uses a song as a kind of analytical tool and also as a creative tool to give new meaning to understood and familiar visuals usually for the purposes of kind of creativity or critique. So you might use the lyrics of a song or the beat of a song or the tone of a song to get your audience to think differently about the visual source material with which they would be familiar. And so another way that you might think about the difference between a commercial music video and a fan music video is that if you were looking for a commercial music video, you'd probably be interested in finding a song by the musical artist. I want to see Kanye West's new video. If you're looking for a fan music video, you want to see an X-Files vid. You want to see a Sherlock Holmes vid. You want to see a Buffy vid. So that what kind of vid it is has to do with the analytical nature of the video and not the music. Does that make sense?
I think it does. And I want to just throw out some examples to make sure that I have and listeners have a clear understanding of at least how we define this term. So, right now, very popular on the internet are these videos done by this group who put these videos out called Bad Lip Reading, which I'm sure you're familiar with. So, for example, if you take a Michael Bublé video and you write a new song under it, as they've done with a brilliant something called Russian Unicorn, where they've taken a video of Michael Bublé's and they've written this song under it about shooting a Russian unicorn. It's all ridiculous, but the video being shown is actually a Bublé video uncut, so it's new music. Is that a vid, or is that something different?
My point of view. In other words. So what you're talking about is, so vidding, let me actually step back a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to jump back and give you some history, and then I promise to answer your question.
Perfect.
here's the story.
Yeah.
YouTube has been a place where a bunch of different kinds of remix video forms now are all being displayed and are mashing up against each other and are actually influencing each other and becoming this kind of wonderful, really huge community of remix video in the broadest sense. Vidding is a specific, narrower community that predates the internet and predates YouTube, as many other forms, by the way, of remix video also predate YouTube. YouTube is the sort of social party to which we've all turned up at. And so the larger question of remix video, remix video really only became visible to people after 2005 and YouTube in particular. But that doesn't mean that it was just... that all was invented, in 2005. And in fact, what happened is that when remix video became public and visible on YouTube, that's really when certain kinds of legal problems started to develop in terms of cease and desist letters and other, other kinds of takedowns and takedowns by algorithms, et cetera. And in fact, the vidding community, which is a narrower subset of remixers, has gotten very involved in legal efforts to keep remix video going that have affected this whole broad community of remix videos. And one of the reasons vidders were able to do that is because we were a really organized community from before the internet. So we really only represent one small. Tish and I come out of one particular kind of remix video that is not that, but in fact have been part of a kind of a community that has been pre-mobilized, as it were, and have been able to do some of the legal lifting that I think has benefited other people who make other kinds of videos.
So if that's the and I'm glad I asked that question, because now we have some contours. So those kinds of videos, which are very popular, are not vids. So let me make sure that I've got the definition clear. When we use the word or the name vid, we are in fact talking about video editing as opposed to something else. Tisha, am I right about that?
Yeah, exactly. It's editing video from a movie or a TV show, sometimes other kinds of source. But usually, if you're talking about other kinds of source, you're talking about a different kind of remix video, like, say, political remix video. And you're editing that source and juxtaposing different pieces of it in order to comment on what's important in that source narrative, to say something about the characters or the relationships or the stories or the subtext. You're doing essentially a close reading of the movie or the TV show, or one part of the movie or the TV show. You're celebrating it or subverting it or refocusing it or reshaping it or sometimes completely reinventing it. That can be interesting too.
So again, I think the semantics, it sounds like semantics, but they're important when we think about these issues, particularly from a copyright perspective. Can a vid have a remixed audio track, or does that immediately put it somewhere else?
No, a vid can absolutely have a remixed audio track. I mean, so for example, you could have a vid set to a mashup, right? So it may be a remixed audio track that the vidder did. It may be a remixed audio track that the vidder got from somewhere else. Some vidders will layer in dialogue from the show or the movie for sort of strategic rhetorical purposes. But basically, it's a music video, but not the kind of thing that you were talking about with the Michael Bublé video. It's cutting the video over an existing pop song.
Got
most
it.
Of the time.
And so let me just throw out one more example with which you might be familiar, but if not, I can certainly describe it. So there were some very, I think funny, but also I think useful from a satirical perspective, videos done early called the Vader Sessions, where a particular author basically took a video from the Star Wars movies and spliced them in with audio from James Earl Jones movies from the 70s. And so it made Darth Vader from this, you know, evil character into basically a 70s stereotypical criminal using all of this soundtrack kind of stuff. Without knowing more about it, is that a vid because it splices both video and audio?
Again, I would say no. I mean,
okay.
That sounds
right.
Like it would be fascinating, and I would love to see those. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a really fun form of remix, but it would not, I think, for most vidders, fall into the tradition of vidding specifically.
Okay. And so this is good. Sure, go ahead. Yeah, Francesca.
The vidding community we come from really is, it's a fairly specific, these are all, that sounds, in fact, kind of close to the, to one of the goals of vidding, which is the reinterpretation of source text, as does much music video. But in fact, the particular kind of vidding that the community that Tish and I come from is very largely a female-dominated community. And one of the things that community is doing is kind of translating some of the mass media spectacular action-adventure science fiction texts into changing their message and changing their tone, and often changing the message. A lot of the criticism has to do with gender politics, sexual politics, sometimes actual kind of implicit other kinds of small p politics. But also vidders tend to change the tone of the source material, often making things more lyrical, more intuitive. I've talked about how vidding sometimes turns mass media, television, and film into something that's more like an aria, is more like musical theater, is more like a poem. These are lyrical forms that are not traditionally associated. We don't really have like mass media poetry. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. Avengers, the poem, the epic poem opening, you know, it tends to be a bit more of a spectacular action adventure form. But if you could imagine the mass media kind of remade to emphasize tone and lyricism, that might sound, and you might say, wow, I really don't want that. And that would be okay. But it turns out that there are a lot of people who do want that and who are looking for a form that's a little bit more like, you know, like Shakespearean soliloquy. And one of the things that music video does is it tends to be more emotionally intense, a little more interior, a little more focused on lyricism than the mass media does. And that's a kind of artistic answer, but that's just to kind of give you a little bit of a sense of the kind of remix video that we're interested in. And as I say, it has been a kind of largely female practice, gay and lesbian practice. It kind of come out of a more specific subculture.
Now, Francesca, again, this is, in terms of the demographics of the community, it's useful to understand where you're coming from. So when you said that it's a female community, are you saying that the vidding community generally is that, or are you talking about a subset of a larger community of vidders?
I'm saying that what Tish and I would call vidding
uh-huh.
is... is this female-dominated okay. community that we ourselves historicize as coming from 1975 and representing a kind of 30-year kind of grassroots, almost sort of feminist. I mean, one of the reasons we were organized as a community and able to kind of testify at DMCA and do other kinds of legal work is that, when Tisha said that she was too poor to Tisha made some of her own computers yep. when she was in graduate school because she, didn't have the money to buy really expensive computers. Vidders taught each other to vid, often by kind of forming collectives of women who would buy technology together and share that technology in the pre-internet days when it was quite expensive to do video editing at home. The computer has made this all much easier. But there was a kind of almost feminist sort of collective group. Now, that being said, that's not all of Remix Video.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what you were talking about before, I mean, I really want to give props to Steve Anderson at USC, who a few years ago ran a fantastic conference called 24/7 DIY, which was a do-it-yourself video conference that he ran out of USC. And he brought political remixers, anime music video, people who did lip dubs, if you've seen those on the internet, mm-hmm. which are often people kind of coming together. They're also music video, but it's not what we would call vids. They're lip dubs, and it's huge numbers of people, often in a single take, kind of choreographing a giant musical to a pop song. There's stuff like literal videos, if you've ever seen them, mm-hmm. Where someone rewrites the audio track and sings along to an existing music video. So if people out there listening, if you want to have a really good laugh, Google Total Eclipse of the Heart literal video, and I promise
I was just going to say that.
Laugh really, really, really hard, right? And then the stuff like you're talking about, Star Wars remixes, fan films, Machinima, right, which is the making of films from inside video game engines. All of these communities of people, right, who all have slightly different traditions are all kind of knocking elbows together on YouTube. And so that's the sort of larger context of Remix Video that it's important to preserve. Now, from a legal standpoint, what's yep. interesting here is that a lot of those groups, and in fact, and I'm going to go on a limb a little bit here and say a lot of times male-dominated groups tend to do stuff that looks a little more overtly like parody. And because it tends to look a little more overtly like parody, it tends to get left alone in the legal marketplace. But the kind of art that Tisha and I make and that the community we come from makes tends to confuse people a little, especially if they're not in the community. They may not really understand what the vidder is saying. And because it's not overtly parodic, it more easily runs afoul of cease and desist or just people not knowing what it is. And so one of the reasons we've had to kind of articulate the more sort of the smaller subcultural vidding community is because it's not broadly understandable by somebody who maybe just clicks on it. It really is a kind of developed art form. When Tisha talks about it as a kind of close reading, it has its own language. We have our own critical vocabulary. We have an annual convention where the vids that premiere, which is like our Oscar season, then go through a two-hour art review afterwards, a public critical art review, right? We then have actually there's also programming that talks about an in-depth vid review where you might take one vid, which is about a three-minute long piece of film, and talk about it for an hour. So in fact, it's a fairly sophisticated art form, but in the marketplace and in the legal culture, people who don't understand it or who don't know what they're seeing might not understand why it's fair use. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is to articulate some of the goals of the community and to say that the law should not stop us from making the kind of art and having the kind of speech that we want to have.
We're chatting with Tisha, before you got it, as a quick break, we're chatting with Professor Francesca Coppa of Muhlenberg College and Professor Tisha Turek of the University of Minnesota at Morris on KGCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tisha?
What I was going to add to what Francesca was saying is that to give you a specific example of one kind of thing that a vid might do. So if you a vidder might take a song that she thinks illustrates something about what's going on inside a particular character's head. Say a character on a show who's fairly stoic or not communicative in some way to the other characters around him and might set a vid to a song that reveals something about that character's interiority. What's he thinking? What are his motives during a particular storyline? How is he thinking about, though perhaps not expressing himself to, the other characters around him? And So someone in the community, someone familiar with vids, might look at that and say, "Oh my gosh, that's so insightful. That's so amazing. That says I see that character the exact same way. Yes, this is what he's thinking. This is what he's feeling." Someone who doesn't know the community, someone who isn't familiar with the sort of conventions of the art form, might look at that and say, "I have no idea what this is. It's not parody, clearly, right? It's deeply sincere. It's not." It's not clearly parody in a legal sense. It's not funny. So what is it? Well, it's transformative. I mean, it's transformative in a broad sense. And one of the reasons that parody has been protected is because of its transformative nature, right? But what we're saying is that there's a larger sort of transformativeness that also needs to be protected.
And Tisha, let's, and I think after the break we'll get into the law and the work you're doing advocating for certain more clear exemptions for this kind of activity in copyright law. What is the Organization for Transformative Works?
Well, Francesca founded it, so I think she should
Fair enough.
About that.
Francesca, back to you.
Yeah, sorry. So what the Organization for Transformative Works is a fan advocacy group that came together in about 2007, partly in response to the kind of commercialization of the internet. And it's an organization made by fans for fans to essentially preserve and advocate for fan works. And that is in a variety of ways. That's both we're developing a hand-coded, we're the largest, I think, female-dominated open source coding project on the web. We have female fan coders, many of whom we've taught, building something called the Archive of Our Own, which is a fan fiction archive, so that which is hosted on our servers in a nonprofit space that nobody owns. And so we're doing that kind of like literal preservation of fan works by giving them a home online. And we're also doing certain kinds of advocacy work, like, for example, the DMCA and other kinds of interventions in the kind of legal and commercial culture.
And the organization itself, and before we go to the break, I'll ask you about that, and perhaps Francesca, I'll continue with you on this point. You have been involved in advocating for certain changes in the law that are currently being considered. So in a couple of minutes before we take a break, can you set the stage for that, which we'll talk about in more detail after the break?
Well, actually, I would disagree in that.
Okay.
What we've actually been trying to do is to assert that we think that what we're doing and what fan culture does fits very well with contemporary copyright law. Mm-hmm. We think that we're fair use. We think we're making transformative works. One of the places that we're advocating has been in terms of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And even
right.
then, we're not changing the law. We're just doing what the law says. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act allows for people who feel that they need an exemption to that law to come together every 3 years and argue as to why you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in 2009, Tisha and I and Rebecca Tushnet, the EFF, and we went and worked with documentary filmmakers and media studies and film professors to argue that we needed an exemption to the DMCA. And I can talk about why bidders needed that exemption, but in fact, we did get an exemption. We were instrumental, in fact, in winning an exemption for non-commercial remixers, broadly speaking. In other words, we went as bidders, but we didn't go only for bidders. We went for all non-commercial remixers, and we did succeed in obtaining an exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act for non-commercial remixers, and we've just recently gone back to ask for that extension, for that exemption to be renewed.
We're chatting with Professor Tisha Turk and Professor Francesca Coppa on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at KZSU and click on donate. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So let's dive a little bit in a little bit more detail into the law. And it's interesting, Francesca, that you pushing back with regard to changes in the law, because I think that is what gets at the somewhat controversial status of vids as Tisha and you have defined them on today's show. And let me ask this broad question, and perhaps Tisha, I'll come back to you from the perspective particularly of someone who makes vids, what do you see as copyright law's views, if I can give them that human touch, or perhaps I should more accurately say copyright law's interpretation of what you do? Why is there a need for an exemption?
Well, the reason there's a need for an exemption is that the DMCA has no fair use provision. I mean, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes ripping DVDs illegal, period. And so if I want to use DVD source to make a vid, which I mostly do because that's typically the best quality source that I have available to me, then that makes the vid illegal, whether or not it's fair use. I would say that it is fair use, right? But if someone were to, say, send me a takedown notice, then I would not really, it wouldn't do me any good to say, but it's fair use, because they would say, well, if you rip DVDs to get it, then it doesn't matter, because that's illegal. Okay, so let's make that not illegal, and then we can talk about the fact that vids are fair use, which I think vids are pretty clearly fair use. I mean, you were talking about the controversial nature of vids. I would disagree. I don't think vids are controversial. I mean, vids are non-commercial, right? They're non-profit. You use a tiny fraction of the original work in relation, you know, if I'm making a 3-minute vid out of a 90-minute movie, let alone a 7-season TV series. I mean, we're talking minuscule amounts. And the effect of the use upon the potential market value of the copyrighted work, I mean, nobody is going to confuse my 3-minute video of Fringe with Fringe, the TV show. I mean, they're completely different in pretty much every conceivable way, except, oh, look, it's Anna Torv on the screen. I mean, but it's as if, to go back to something that Francesca was talking about earlier, it's as if I had written a sonnet based on, you know, Tony Kushner's Angels in America. I mean, even if it was a great sonnet, it would not be the same as that play. It would just, it's a change in genre. It's a change in form. It's a change in length. I mean, so for all of those reasons, I think vids fit the fair use criteria, at least the use of video, and, you know, the use of audio might be something different. We can maybe talk more about that later. But in terms of video, I don't think there's much controversy over the idea that vids are fair use. So the DMCA exemption was necessary to let us get to the point of being able to make that argument.
So, Jessica, I'll come to you on this question, but let me push back for a moment with regard to the potential controversy. And it gets really to, you know, the question of what is a transformative work, which is an age-old question in copyright law that obviously pervades copyright law. It's not just one that vidders have to face. In the reply comment that you submitted, you made reference to a video called Der Commissar. And the video, as I saw it, is a video where the vidder used portions of a variety of James Bond films and set them to what I think is a cover version of the original Falco song "Der Commissar," that is a regular, by the way, in my short playlist when I'm running around on an elliptical runner. And what the video is, though, is, and again, it clearly meets your definition of a vid, is taking this sound, this cover version of "Der Commissar," and then using bits and pieces of other James Bond films that are somewhat synced, although not entirely, to the music itself. Now, to push back for a moment, what one could say is that this is nothing more than a cut and paste of the heart of the work, right? And that therefore it is not transformative, right? So that's the pushback where I think the controversy is, but you can tell me if I'm wrong. How is it, in your view, that Der Commissar, by way of example, is transformative? And perhaps it leads to the larger question, which is how you define a transformative work.
Francesca knows Der Commissar better. So.
Yeah, please.
And that's a great example. And let me just add, I mean, you know, Tisha just gave you a list of, we actually don't think this is actually I'm quite happy to talk about it, but this actually isn't really the controversial part. As I say, even our adversaries came to the place of not disputing that Der Commissar was transformative. But in addition to Tisha's list of the relatively small amount of source material, the non-commerciality, the change of genre, the critical tone, etc. I want to add, first of all, to say that vids are also a really important form of speech, and that they give voice to parts of the world and different kinds of communities whose voices may not be heard when it comes to the mass media. And that ties in really well to Der Kommissar, because, in fact, I'm writing a lot about Bond at the moment. And I think this is a case where what you see and what you saw when you watched Der Kommissar, and what somebody who is a vidder or in the vidding community and has seen a lot of vids would see when they saw that vid are very different. Mm-hmm. And in fact, part of the evidence we submitted about Der Kommissar is that the community to whom that video was released had no trouble understanding what I'm about to like outline to you now.
Okay.
But what's interesting about it is, you know, think about James Bond for a minute. James Bond is a kind of classic, masculine, heterosexist, macho kind of figure of the 20th century. He is a figure that, you know, as much as he is this kind of wildly successful form of masculinity, he is not subject to critique. I mean, I think women often find Bond, at least the women in the community I come from, problematic in various kinds of ways, mm-hmm. right? And one of the things that video does, I mean, you're saying it's sort of mostly synced, or it's very synced. And in fact, the video actually undercuts Bond in all sorts of ways. And round about the middle actually starts to create a kind of queer narrative of Bond. Mm-hmm. They show Bond is afraid of sharks and also is afraid of his wife.
Right.
There are certain kinds of messages about Bond's sexual politics where Bond's kind of masculinity is undercut. And later on, the vid starts to develop a kind of homoerotic reading of Bond. And in fact, that's done, if you understand the language of the video, you can see the vid as critiquing its sexual politics. But also think about the song. Der Kommissar is a kind of cheesy 80s vision of a kind of, you know, Soviet German bloc functionary, right?
Right.
Don't turn around, Der Kommissar's in town, you know, the secret police. The song itself,
which is particularly powerful in German, by the way.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, I know the Falco as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, Bond, that's the milieu of Bond, right? In the actual film GoldenEye, M calls Bond a sexist, misogynist dinosaur of the Cold War. And I would argue to you that actually setting Bond to Der Kommissar after the Cold War is now over, right, kind of actually uses that song to puncture some of the kind of pretentiousness. The song is camp the way Bond is camp, right, where this kind of German secret police milieu is. So the music is actually sort of doing something, I think, undercutting of Bond as well from a kind of political point of view, right? It casts, Der Kommissar casts the Bond villains as these kinds of, you know, crypto-Slovak functionaries. So, in fact, it's doing something quite complicated, but it may not be doing something that the average fan of YouTube who just clicks on it may not get any of it. They just may go, okay, there's clips, and they're happening very quickly. The reason I was talking about poetry, and you know, Tisha mentioned sonnet, is that there's a very it's a very dense language. Nothing will infuriate a vidder more than if you look away from the screen during a vid. In other words, literally, there have been vidders who've been known to work on a vid frame by frame, so that the amount of information in a vid is actually extremely dense. And if you're not expert at reading them, you may not know what you're seeing. And it's our position that the law shouldn't be telling us what we can say because it's not speech that's meaningful to them. It's really meaningful to the community out of which it comes and for which it's made.
And so that and that gets to, and Tish, I want to come back to you as well on this, because that gets to, you know, I think where you see the problem in the law is not as much about the definition of fair use. You know, it raises, and I think the response to my question raises this issue, which I do want to also talk about with regard to lawyers having to, in many ways, be de facto judges of the value or merit of a given piece of work by virtue of copyright law. But before we get there, let's talk about where you see the problem, which is in technological protection measures preventing you from doing the work that you do. Tisha, as one who not only advocates on these issues but actually creates vids, when you come across a TPM, what is the line of reasoning that you go through in deciding I'm going to go forward to the extent that you run into a technological protection measure?
Well, if I run into a technological protection measure that's keeping me from doing what I want to do, I find a way around it. I mean, this is one of the things that I said when we did the original, back in 2009, when we were testifying before the copyright office, I said, you know, I don't want to alarm anybody, but I have anti-circumvention measures and I know how to use them. And yet I still own DVDs. I mean, the big argument was, oh, you know, if we let people do this, you know, piracy, you know, the collapse of the DVD economy. I mean, it was very like Chicken Little, sky is falling kind of thing. But, if I need to get around them, I get around them. So I wouldn't say that the DMCA impedes vidding. I was vidding with DVSource way before the exemption made it legal. And frankly, I would do so again, even if the exemption was not renewed. But I might be much more cautious about how and where I publicized those vids. And I might be much more reluctant to fight a takedown notice if I got one, because my legal standing would be much more shaky. And that's the way in which the DMCA has a chilling effect. It doesn't necessarily have a chilling effect on the making of vids, but it certainly has a chilling effect on the defending of vids as fair use of copyrighted material.
And, you know, and this is an issue that is coming up on the international level as well. Right now, what's being negotiated in San Diego, literally, as the show is being recorded on July 5th, the negotiations are ongoing, is a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement where the U.S. is making pretty bold steps, as far as we can tell, because the negotiations are secret and the public doesn't have access to a text. But if we go on speculation and conjecture, the U.S. is pushing heavily for pretty very strong IP laws, although they just announced literally yesterday or 2 days ago that they're going to attempt to push something along the lines of a three-step process to have some balances. Having said all of that, one of the big issues in TPP is the very issue you're describing, technological protection measures and anti-circumvention as being a barrier to accessing works that would then have a fair use element to them or be entirely fair use. Do you think, Tisha, and I'll come back to you, Francesca, in a moment on this, is your reaction and handling of this at best nebulous and at worst totally ill-informed law the general reaction of the vidding community, or do you think that there are vidders or putative vidders who are deciding not to create their art because of the concern that they're going to run afoul of these measures?
There may be vidders who are deciding, or potential vidders who are deciding not to vid because of these measures. But my sense is that, you know, one of the problems with the law from a layperson's point of view, from a vidder's point of view, and remember that vidders are often very young. I mean, I'm a college professor in my 30s, but people are making vids at 14, 15, mm-hmm. younger sometimes, right? Is that it's quite opaque. I mean, it's not immediately clear why, if you bought DVDs, you shouldn't be able to use them to do stuff with them. Why should that not be the case? I mean, if I paid for it, if I'm not pirating it, right? If it is not copying the entire thing to sell to somebody else, so why would that not be okay? I mean, so my sense is that it's problematic in that way. And one of the arguments that Rebecca Tushnet made at the DMCA hearings is that the exemption helps clarify something that isn't clear and ought to be.
Mm-hmm. And so that gets to I think a very interesting and problematic area of copyright law. In your submission, you said, and this is a quote: "Lawyers in general should not be in the business of evaluating or interpreting art." Semicolon. The copyright laws are not designed to protect only that which lawyers think is worthwhile expression. And even if one is sympathetic with that, and I certainly am, and this is again one of the big problems with copyright law, because particularly fair use, and even the idea expression dichotomies and the basis of copyright law does require line drawing, and that line drawing often appears to be a value judgment as to whether a piece of art is good. So, Francesco, I'll come to you as someone who's looked at the history of this. Is this a problem, do you think, that is engendered by the advent of technology, and in fact, as Tisha's pointed out, the ability of individuals to actually do vidding who wouldn't have had that access otherwise because they wouldn't have the equipment and the computers and so forth? Or is this something which, and this problem of lawyers judging art, a problem that you think has been running through the vidding community prior to technology?
I need to point out, there's sort of two pieces to the question. Mm-hmm. The question of whether lawyers ought to judge art, I think is preposterous. I mean, I'm even shocked to hear you say that you think that that's how that there's some way in which that makes sense.
Oh no, well let me be clear. I'm
I mean, the reason I say that is there's got to be a way to figure out that something's fair use. I mean, you know, it may be that you think someone's written a lousy poem. But I feel like we do want to I defend the right of people to make lousy poems the way that I feel that they should make lousy vids. In other words, it's much easier to talk about the nature and purpose of the work, the content of the work. I mean, it may be that something fails artistically so spectacularly that you can't at all even identify what it is.
Well, let me be clear about the question so that you answer the question that I intend to ask, even if I maybe didn't say it as artfully. I'm not suggesting that should be the case. I'm merely suggesting that, in fact, legal standards often make it or at least appear to give lawyers that opportunity, right? Precisely because when we think about transformation, when we're talking about making something new, invariably you will see judges and lawyers arguing about whether it's something new, which looks like, right, an evaluation or interpretation of art. So I'm not suggesting that it should be that way. In fact, I have severe concerns about it. But what I'm asking is, do you think that copyright law, in effect, even if we don't think it's good policy, requires that kind of judgment?
I see, and I don't think it does.
Okay,
that I think we're doing a pretty good job at trying to explain is that, in fact, you know, what you were saying about is something transformative. That's quite a complicated question. You both have to know what you have to have some consensus on what the original was saying, and then some consensus on what the new work is saying, right? And then some sense of being able to measure that. But what I want to point out to you is how that could potentially be particularly oppressive to any kind of minority interpretation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got two English professors on the show. We can't agree about what Hamlet means, right? We're still writing books on that play 400 years later, right?
I'll tell you what it means. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, I feel like the lawyers will, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You clearly can't do that.
No, that's my point. Yeah, right.
So, you know, in that sense, you clearly don't want to come up with any sort of a standard. And in fact, I really don't think that the law has that sort of a standard.
Okay.
You know, Fred von Lohmann, actually, when he was with the EFF, had suggested at some point that YouTube literally consider, you know, whether the audio and visual track matched. I mean, he had a couple of very, very specific kind of rubrics that you could put onto a video that tended to indicate whether it was fair use or not, none of which had to do with quality. But here's the larger, you know, I mean, again, vidding is very interesting to Tish and I, and we would talk about it all day. But to the extent to which it fits into this kind of larger cultural issue that I think you and your readers are interested in, we're at a moment right now where we're really, I mean, you can say we're in a wonderful chaotic moment, or you can say we're in a moment of total disconnect about video. And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, I teach film studies, and one of the things that, you know, we talk about at the Liberal Arts College is how to encourage students to read and write multimedia. Well, how are you going to write multimedia if at the same time you're coming up with a culture where technological limitations are trying to stop students from writing with media, right? And we're talking about vidding as a subcultural art form, but you could talk about the kinds of videos that students might make in classes, right? That we are trying, on the one hand, to teach what we now call multimedia literacy at the same time as that there's a move in the culture to kind of lock down access to the tools of reading and writing. So that if you start to think about some of these issues in terms of broader questions of literacy, it becomes really problematic. We want students, you know, literacy isn't just reading and writing. And in fact, even the business of quoting literary quotations in text has become more fraught in this environment. That the intellectual property regimes have gotten kind of so colonialist, yeah. Right, that you even... you know, students aren't even sure how to quote text, right? Does this text belong to somebody? How much can I use? Which I think is exactly the wrong direction, that we need to be able to quote with video the way we quote with text in a literary essay. And at the same time, the other piece that makes this complicated is the commercialization of the internet and the extent to which that the kind of very air that we now publish in is now owned by corporations. So, in a real way, the real problem that vidders have is that you make your vid, which is a form of speech. You have something that you want to say, you know, about, I'll give you a really clear example. When the new Star Trek film came out, the 2011 reboot. 2009 reboot, right. Star Trek came out. There was a vid made called to Too Many Dicks on the Dance Floor. And it was a vid made sort of starring Uhura, which was sort of felt that, you know, that actually when you look at the Enterprise Bridge in 2009, it kind of seems weird that she's the only woman there. Yes, for 1966, it was kind of great you had a black woman on the bridge, but now that she's the only one, we sort of feel, well, you know, we could actually probably have stood a couple more female characters in that universe, you know, while they were rebooting it. And that's something that somebody wanted to say about that movie, you know, when it came out, right? And so the question is, what, you know, and to say that, though, you have to make it, and then you have to post it on a commercial site like YouTube, because where else do you speak? And YouTube is owned by somebody, and then there's a corporation that then can decide that they want to send a cease and desist on it because they own, right? Everybody owns a piece of what you want to say. And it's this whole matrix of the words. It's as if you're trying to write poetry and people are asserting copyright on the English language. Like, mm-hmm. You need to make sentences out of pre-existing words. And you can make other kinds of forms of speech out of bits of pre-existing culture. Our heads are all... This is where I am a Lessegite. I mean, our heads are full of bits and pieces of culture that we're collaging together in interesting ways. And we just can't live or communicate in a system in which everybody's going to kind of assert ownership of that, because then no new speech is possible. And I think Tish and I really want to emphasize that it's new speech. Nobody is defending ripping a DVD and selling it, right? I mean, nobody's defending kind of piracy in that way. We're talking about making something new out of something old, which is how all the culture in the history of the world has worked.
We are chatting with Professor Francesca Coppa of Muhlenberg College and Professor Tisha Turk at the University of Minnesota at Morris on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tisha and Francesca, unfortunately, we only have a couple of minutes left, and of course, even in an hour, we can only touch the tip of the iceberg. By virtue of your answers, I think you're illustrating where copyright law has severe problems, because it's certainly, in my view, the fact that copyright law is interfering clearly at the level that it is with artists is exactly what it should not be doing. Having said that, and really, you know, to close the interview, although I will tell you up front that I invite you back to continue this discussion, particularly after there's more resolution of the TPM issue, which I think is absolutely critical and illustrates that idea of code being law that Lessig and others certainly have been asserting over the last 15 years. In terms of what you think non-vitters could do to support the work that you do, Tisha, I'll come to you. What could, and in a short amount of time, this is your classic, you have 30 seconds, what could non-vitters do to support the work not only of the Organization for Transformative Works, but more broadly, vitters in general?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that in 30 seconds as I sit here stalling for time. I mean, I think that one of the things that non-vitters could do would be to be aware of the ways in which copyright law constrains certain kinds of expression. I mean, to be aware that there are communities of practice that that communicate in ways that that the mainstream culture isn't familiar with and doesn't understand, and the law is attempting to regulate those things. And I think it's easy to say, well, we don't get that weirdo thing that they do, so it's no big deal. But to be aware that, as Francesca pointed out, in an era in which everything is increasingly commercialized, the kind of speech and the kind of meaning that other folks care about could well be next. Not to sound sort of apocalyptic about that.
Mm-hmm. Francesca, you have anything quickly you want to add on that point?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is we are all vitters now, and we are all vitters now in that you can probably not go through your day without, on some level, doing something potentially infringing. And as you know, as the saying goes, fair use is a muscle, and everybody, bitter and non-bitters, have to exercise it. And I think that, you know, if people become aware of their rights and of fair uses and try to flex those fair use muscles, argue, if you're at school, and certainly if you're a gatekeeper at schools or at institutions, if you're a librarian at your university, if you're the sort of legal department at your firm, that I think if you're in the position to actually make some policy in your home or school or workplace that is pro fair use less conservative than more. I think people's natural inclination is to, in an era of uncertainty, kind of pull back and use fewer rights. And I think if I had a message to everybody, it's use more rights. Go to the edge of what you're comfortable with. Stretch out a little bit. I'm not saying do things that are illegal. I'm saying assert, you know, become familiar with what are your rights under the existing law. I mean, by all means, feel free to advocate to change the law to make it even better. But even under the law, you have a number of rights, and that you should use them to the fullest capacity. And in fact, don't allow yourself to kind of pull back and to not use those rights.
Professor Francesca Coppa of Muhlenberg College and Professor Tisha Turek of the University of Minnesota at Morris, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Again, touching the tip of the iceberg of this, I think not only fascinating in terms of its development, but important community, giving us a real sense of what the power of technology properly deployed and law properly positioned can do to create these unbelievably interesting and impressive works that you've described. Tisha, for those that want to learn more about your vids and access vids, where can they go? I know that the Organization of Transformative Works website is at transformativeworks.org. But for actually seeing vids, where do you recommend people look?
Well, for people who haven't seen vids before, there's actually a really great test suite of vids on the Transformative Works site that we put together specifically for use at the DMCA hearings. And I think that would be an excellent place to begin. There are sort of annotations on the vids to maybe help people who are not familiar with them understand what it is that they're seeing. Where can you find vids? I mean, where can't you find vids? They're, you know, throw a rock on YouTube and hit them. There are lots of other places as well. They're on other video streaming sites. They're, you know, available for download various places. But I think that the OTW Vidding Test Suite would be a great place to begin.
Francesca and Tisha, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and having this discussion. Certainly on a personal level, I wish you as much success as is possible in your efforts to attempt to remove technology as a barrier to fair use, which I think is just a fundamentally problematic issue in copyright law. And certainly your suggestions with regard to balancing copyright law are things that we need from the perspective of the legal community. Having just put myself in a position of speaking for all lawyers, which is no big deal. So thank you again for joining us today on the show. I greatly appreciate the time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
I'm excited to point out that the schedule for this quarter is up on hearsayculture.com. For time reasons, I'm not going to rattle off all the names, but I'm very excited the guests that are coming up. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.